Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 1. Introduction to the Jewish Philosophy of Man, originally delivered on November 6th, 1958.
Just give me a little while, Alice.
I don't know, I'm a newcomer here, and I'd like to know, what is it? Is it a lecture or a seminar? I would like to understand it better, if you could explain it to me. It's more of a symposium, a discussion, or it's a straight lecture? I mean, it depends upon you, I mean, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, it's the same to me. It's a combination. So I would perhaps make a compromise that I would lecture, but you have a right, and I would rather appreciate if you would interrupt my lecture in case you have a question to ask. This is my policy. I have been a teacher for many, many years. My policy is that if students interrupt me if they want to ask me a question. So I would appreciate if you should interrupt me and if something is not clear or you have a question or if you disagree with me.
Rabbi, you have to speak a little louder.
Yes. This is not a loudspeaker. I thought it's a loudspeaker. If you... I mean, there is no loudspeaker here. So anyway...
Would it be easier for you to sit in the middle of...
I believe it would be much easier.
Excuse me a minute.
Philosophy of religion. Philosophy of religion at many levels. It means modern philosophy of religion, comparative philosophy of religion, medieval philosophers, Jewish and Christian, and so forth and so on. My training basically was not in the field of philosophy of religion, but the philosophy of science, Kantian, neo-Kantian philosophy. So perhaps I have a strange approach to philosophy of religion, because my training was not a theological one or exclusively in the field of philosophy of religion and religious thought. However, I've been cast in or thrust in using an expression by Heidegger into certain environment where philosophy of religion was considered important. So I tried to interpret, Jewish religious concepts in philosophical terms. To tell you that I know much about it, I would not be sincere. Basically, I am very perplexed, and perhaps as perplexed as anybody else and more. And I don't believe that Judaism is a philosophy, is a religion which has many answers, like the Catholic philosophy. Judaism has many problems, but very few answers. Very few answers. And perhaps the more I lecture, the more perplexed you will be, and the more I'll confuse you instead of clearing up some problems in your mind. And however, but it's good if you can see a problem and to understand the problem is insoluble. And actually, and my mind says that to be perplexed does not mean to be confused. And whatever I'll say, I'm not laying claim to any theoretical or cognitive validity. I don't know whether what I'm going to say is true or not. It's hard to say. We don't have criteria by which objectively to judge our opinions about Judaism. We have no laboratory, we have no tests. The empirical approach we have, I wouldn't say is as developed as in the field of positive sciences. All I'll say to you is just my own subjective thoughts and feelings about Judaism. I have tried to interpret Judaism in modern terms. I mean, for the Jew in his encounter with the modern world, I've tried very hard. But it's only a subjective experience and a subjective interpretation on my part. I'm not out to convert anybody. I'm not carrying the gospel of Judaism. I lack missionary zeal. Whatever I'll do, take it as an act of confidence on my part, as confessing, or rather letting you share my own subjective experience, my own private experience. If you should find that my experience and there is some commensurability between your feelings and my experience, my efforts will be rewarded. However, if you should find that my experience and your experiences are incommensurable, incongruous, then you'll disagree with me totally, I will not feel hurt. Because it's very hard, I mean, to find commensurability between private experiences of individuals. So the trait of uniqueness actually precludes commensurability. In general, whoever speaks about Judaism or makes an authoritative statement, I don't believe, I'm not saying about Jewish law, but about Jewish philosophy, is wrong. It's just a subjective interpretation. We have no authority to determine which philosophy is, let's say, the perennial Jewish philosophy, and which one is just a modern, transient interpretation of Judaism. Now, I believe that the topic of our lectures would deal with man and his social institutions he created. But today I wouldn't speak about man. I'll just give an introduction as to the methodology of Judaism and how you can approach this problem. Judaism has a doctrine of man. Because if it has no doctrine of man, so you could get up and go home. As a matter of fact, such a doctrine underlies every civilized religion. Any civilized religion, not only Judaism, Christianity and Islam, must have a doctrine of man. Since religion is concerned with the relationship, with the triple relationship of God, man, and the world, this is the basic relationship in any philosophy of religion, it must necessarily possess some knowledge, on the one hand, of God's infinite will, which conveys to man the moral law, and the means by which this moral law is to be realized, and, on the other hand, of man himself, the subject of the good religious conduct and the ethical norm. Now, let me add something. Cognition, or knowledge, is one of the main motives which determine and shape the religious experience. The homo religiosus, it's a technical term, it means the man of the religious experience. The homo religiosus is engaged in a cognitive gesture. Is basically a theoretical man, a homo theoreticus, or anthropos theoreticus. The intellectual urge is as potent in him as it is in the homo theoreticus. Curiosity prompts both the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus to face the world and men in an inquisitive mood or inquiring. I am saying that because many theories in the history of philosophy of religion have maintained that religion is not a cognitive gesture. It's either, as Schleiermacher wanted us to believe, an emotional gesture. And the main, so to say, the main experience of the homo religiosus can be reduced to the feeling of absolute dependence. Or, as Kant and the Neo-Kantian school maintained, the religious experience is an ethical one, a moral experience, the experience of the absolute imperative. So, Schleiermacher sentimentalized religion, Kant ethicized religion. Both of them have eliminated the intellectual urge of the homo religiosus. The homo religiosus doesn't want to know, what he wants to act. That's what Kant said. Schleiermacher said, the homo religiosus doesn't want to know, nor does he want to act. He feels something. He is emotionally unique. However, intellectually, volitionally, ethically, morally, there is no uniqueness to him, no singularity. However, it's impossible to maintain this attitude, particularly if in modern religion. The religious experience has basic, central, intellectual, or cognitive motifs. Like the homo theoreticus, whoever he is, a scientist, psychologist, a philosopher, the religious person is a person who seeks knowledge. Of course, the objectives and hence the methods of the homo religiosus and the homo theoreticus are different. They vary. The homo theoreticus studies a reality bounded in by finitude. That's all. He doesn't know of any other reality. Finitude and reality are identical to him, whose multifarious complexities are reduced or can be reduced to relational, formal, mathematical equations and to a system of dynamic interdependencies whose rationale, the rationale of reality, and science must believe in the rationale of reality, but otherwise the scientists would never approach reality in a confident mood. There is a rationale in reality, whose rationale manifests itself in expressibility and technological applicability. This is the approach on the part of the scientist to reality. The homo religiosus explores being at a different level, not so much for the sake of discovering the here and now knowable, explainable, and useful aspects. He's also interested in that. But his main interest centers about something else. He is not so much interested in the, so to say, in the knowledge of reality which is accessible to us, but he is more interested in transcending the charted lanes of an orderly and neatly arranged cosmos or universe and venturing into the unknown, into remote, empty distances and boundless stretches, into a strange and puzzling and baffling world which can neither be mathematized or interpreted, nor interpreted in abstract constructs and concepts, whose total equation, because for the homo theoreticus, the total equation of the universe is, it is knowable. Of course, if the universe were not knowable, comprehensible, there would be actually a gesture of resignation on the part of the scientist or the homo theoreticus. The equation, the total equation of the homo religiosus says existence is a paradoxical affair, a mysterium magnum, which inspires a man awe and tremor. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, in order to arrive at such an absurd equation, or, if I may use Kierkegaard's expression, to perform the movement of resignation, which is basic for the homo religiosus. Homo religiosus must resign from time to time. In order to perform the act or the movement of complete resignation, the homo religiosus must explore every nook and corner of reality. Examine, search every aspect of being and try to interpret even the minutest process in reality. Because the act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is not to be equated with the naivete of the uninitiated, ignorant person. Who denies the worth of knowledge because he doesn't know anything. Not to be equated. Whoever the homo religiosus is, he must not be an ignorant person, nor must he be an arrogant person. Ignorance and arrogance are certain traits which are completely, are strange to the religious experience, incommensurate with the religious awareness. This skepticism, which flows from an arrogant attitude, is alien to the homo religiosus. The act of resignation on the part of the homo religiosus is rather to be compared with the skepsis of the ecclesiasts or the despair of Faust by Goethe, who because of having attained great intellectual heights, because of their incessant drinking from the fountainhead of wisdom and their mastery of the cognitive gesture and their insatiable curiosity have arrived at the conclusion that being is an insoluble equation. But it is a resignation which follows knowledge and completes the act of knowing, not an act of resignation which precludes knowledge, because to resign before one knows is not resignation. This is arrogance and ignorance. Of course, only the mathematician can prove that certain equations are insoluble. The person who is not initiated in mathematics cannot prove that. And the homo religiosus is the mathematician who tries to prove, who feels that the total equation of reality is an insoluble one. Perhaps a great mystery. But he is a man of knowledge. He is an intellectual. He is driven by the so-called, if I may use a Kantian expression, the metaphysical impulse. He wants to know. Not only wants to act, not only he feels differently, he wants to know. And of course, the homo religiosus knows of and is concerned with and is guided by and by existential purposes which surpass the boundary lines of finitude. True. He's also in another respect, he is different from the scientist. The scientist studies only reality which is bounded in by finitude, by the frames of reference of time and space. However, the homo religiosus knows of another existence. I wouldn't say another existence, because this would sound a little too theological, but of an existence which transcends the boundaries of finitude. And the boundaries of finitude which is conditioned by temporality. Yet, irrespective of the ultimate end which religion pursues, and which is above and outside the worldly ambitions and aspirations of the homo theoreticus, irrespective of that, the drama of religion unfolds only within the confines of our natural orders. It means within the confines of this worldliness. Right here and now, and this is basically Jewish, right here and now, in a world of sound and color, of sensuous complexities, of change and development, of mechanical motion and unalterable processes, the homo man has his rendezvous with infinity, with God. In order to meet God, one does not have to transcend this world. Although perhaps he knows of a higher existence, but meeting God, and this is basically Jewish. Perhaps Christianity disagreed. I would say medieval Christianity in this respect will come later. this point, to return to this point. The Jewish opinion was, I mean, Jews always said, Judaism, that one meets God right here and now, within the confines of time and space. Here and now, in the midst of the events, of a world of events and things, of mechanical orders, man rises to great heights and meets his creator, and he also falls into a bottomless abyss of sin and actually inferior existence. Right here and now, he rebels against God and his authority, which he accepted prior to his rebellion. And right here and now, he returns to God meekly and humbly, like a child who apologizes to his father, against whom he rebelled a while ago. But it's in the right here and now reality. Right here and now, man struggles with absurdity and insensateness and tries to infuse meaning into something unknown, which we call existence. If, of course, gentlemen, the theater of religious activities, of religious self-expression and self-realization is to be found here in our sensuous world, then understanding of and acquaintanceship with the latter, with this world, is a conditio sine qua non for the proper guiding, for the proper realization of our religious destiny. So it means what I wanted to say is that religion lays claims to knowledge, and this knowledge does not pertain to eternity or to some transcendental entities or to some spiritual beings, but religion wants to know this world, this corporeal, sensuous world, in all its manifestations and in all its, so to say, at all its levels, like the scientist or the homo theoreticus. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, it is a truism that although the cognitive gesture of the homo religiosus is a comprehensive one, aiming at reality in its entirety, manifesting itself in a variety of orders, the homo religiosus is mainly concerned with the order of personal existence. Or, to be more exact, with himself. Of course, he wants to know the world, certainly. No doubt about it. But he's more concerned with himself. Perhaps there is a distinction between the homo theoreticus and the homo religiosus. The homo theoreticus, until recently, was more concerned with the outside world, with the physical processes, with motion, since the days of Thales. He was more concerned with the organic matter, with the process of life, which is also, I mean, belongs into the outside world. He was less concerned with himself, the scientist, because simply if the scientist had been concerned with himself as much as he was concerned with the outside world, this dead matter and animate matter, then perhaps psychology and sociology, all the humanities, would have progressed much more. Because actually knowledge of man is a latecomer in the history of science. It's a newcomer, actually. All right, in history of philosophy, you know, Socrates said, what is man? But it was a different approach. It was not knowledge, theoretical knowledge. It was more a practical problem. What should man do in order to be happy? This was the general problem of the Greek philosophers. Not who is man, what is man, what is the existential experience, what kind of a being he is, what is his uniqueness, singularity, his station in the world, in universe. I mean, his struggle with the outside world and struggle with himself. No, this was not a problem of Socrates, nor was it a problem of Aristotle or Plato, his master Plato, nor was it a problem of the Stoics and the Epicurean school. The problem was a practical one, a pragmatic one, a functional problem. How can man be happy? How can he attain eudaimonia, However, they call it pleasure, hedone. It's a practical problem. And the whole discussion about man in Greek philosophy, in the late antique, I mean, the Greek philosophy, from Socrates and down. So it did not revolve about the metaphysic of man or theory of man. It was more revolving about the practical discipline of man. How can man be happy? It's a technological problem about man, not a theoretical problem. And you know very well that technological problems cannot be solved unless you do basic research. And this was the trouble with the Greek philosophers. When it came, I mean, to the outside world, they were pure theoreticians. The pragmatic view absolutely did not mislead them at all. They wanted to understand for the sake of knowledge. Of course, you know, the idea of technology, it was alien to the Greeks, completely alien, because the type of knowledge he was pursuing did not lend itself to technological application. However, when he came to man himself, he suddenly turned into a technician. Not who is man, what is man, but how should man act in order to be happy. And of course, the Homo religiosus is concerned with man and has a double problem. Who is man? And also the old Greek problem, the pragmatic problem. What shall a man do in order, I mean, to realize or to find self-fulfillment? Religion must possess intimate knowledge and understanding at all levels of the existential experience, or what you call self-awareness. Otherwise, the God-man relationship could remain an enigma to the homo religiosus. If he doesn't understand himself, how can he approach God? However universally true the aforementioned maxim is, that the homo religiosus is intellectual type and is particularly interested in self-knowledge, it is true. Various religions differ as to the manner in which they emphasize the above-mentioned cognitive aspects of the homo religiosus. While most religious systems, and I'm speaking, I know very, when I say most religion systems, I am referring to Occidental religion. I have very little knowledge of Oriental religion. I have no right to speak, not even to mention it. Occidental religion. Occidental religion, I understand Christianity and Islam. I'm quite well acquainted with the Christian scholastics, more or less. Most religious systems were more prone to the theological thinking and developed theosophic doctrines, focusing their attention upon transcendental reality. And they developed only latent religious anthropologies. I mean, to distinguish it from scientific anthropology, you call religious anthropology. When you say religious anthropology, it means the metaphysic of man, the interpretation of man, formulated in religious terms. Of course, for instance, take Christianity. They have a social philosophy, no doubt about it. I mean, Thomas Aquinas developed quite an extensive social philosophy based upon natural law, lex naturalis or lex naturae. But however, it's funny, it's strange. They developed a social philosophy without inquiring into the essence of man. How can you develop a social philosophy before you inquire into man for himself? Regardless of all the controversies about the relationship of man for himself, man within the community, we'll come later to this problem, to this controversy, where that community precedes the individual and the individual precedes the community, I mean systematically, conceptually. But however, Thomas Aquinas was not concerned with the problem, who is man? He was concerned, what is society? And that is the reason why social philosophy is incomplete, because it lacks the basic, so to say, the basic premise, knowledge of man for himself, man in seclusion. Man communing not with the other self, but man communing with himself. That only lately, Christian philosophy began to develop. And actually, this aspect of religious anthropology, dealing with the individual. And of course, this is what we know, what's known to us, under the name or the title religious existentialism. There are many books were written about religious existentialism. What it is, it means the philosophy of man, interpreted in terms of Christianity. That is exactly, more or less, if we want to simplify this equation. However, Judaism occupied a very unique, so to say, position in the world of religion. While other religions stressed the idea of God more than that of man, Judaism, in its intellectual pursuit, concentrated on man. And religious anthropology replaced in Judaism theology. We have always inquired into the essence of man, never into the essence of God. Hence, our world formula is quite paradoxical. It is theocentric, God-centric, theocentric. However, anthropo-oriented. We are orientated on man. We concentrate, so to say, more teleologically on God. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. Judaism maintains that as any other civilized religion. Because if it's not the beginning and the end of everything, there is no need for religion. I can never understand where religion becomes so modernized that the idea of God is eliminated. Not that the zeal of the fanatic, is that what makes me rebel against it, but it's a simple question. If this is religion, so there is no need to spend so much money on its institutions. We are theocentric, but anthropo-orientated. Of course, God is the beginning and the ultimate end of everything. In him, the fullness of existence is realized, and all yearnings of man find fulfillment. No doubt about it. It's very important for the therapeutic aspects of religion. Yet God himself, creator of the world, out of whose pure, absolute, infinite being, finitude emerged, God himself remains to us Jews, Keil mistater beshafri chevien, Deus absconditus, a mysterium tremendum, a hidden God, inapproachable, unknowable, inexpressible, eluding the grasp of our concepts. And if you'll allow me, I want here to just to raise one to call your attention to one dichotomy, or rather to an antithesis in our religious experience. Our experience of God, the Judaic experience of God, of course, you'll find it in other religions as well. But particularly the Judaic experience of God is antithetic. Insofar, it contains an awareness of both, of endless remoteness and mystery on the one hand, and of intimate closeness and familiarity on the other hand. Don't ask me how is it possible. Because basically, Judaism, in its approach to God, did not operate with the Aristotelian two-valued logic, or with the famous principle of contradiction or the excluded middle. Aristotle said, if it is A, it cannot be at the same time B. If it is B, it cannot be at the same time A. It's either A or B. And if it's A or B, it cannot be something else. We Jews say, it's typical of our mentality. It can be A in the same time B. And not only it can be A at the same time B, it can be A and the same time B, and also something else than A and B. Ladies and gentlemen, modern physics, classical physics, operate with this. For instance, the theory of light is interpreted nowadays both in terms of waves and in terms of particles, although both theories are mutually exclusive. So apparently, actually, the modern advanced mathematics and advanced physics actually cannot operate simply. The metaphenomena does not lend itself to a two-valued logical interpretation. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle was thrown away by the scientists. But in the religious approach, it's certainly that we operate with antithetic ideas, concepts. On the one hand, he is remote, on the other hand, he is close. In our encounter with God, we find ourselves many a time bewildered by the opposition of two experiential alternatives. First, as I said before, Deus absconditus, God who is hiding in the depths of infinity and eternity. And second, as the psalmist says, Karov Hashem lechol korav, the Lord is nigh unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth and sincerity. He is both, he is nigh and remote, he is near and far away. This is the Jewish experience of God. On the one hand, we experience God as dwelling apart and beyond all dimensions of being, hidden in the remotest recesses of infinity, unapproachable and incomprehensible, abiding in concealment and in the shadows of transcendence. And the word, the Hebrew word kadosh, holy, whoever knows the etymological meaning of kadosh, know that kadosh actually, in Hebrew, signifies separateness, difference, otherness, incommensurability, something which doesn't belong into disorder, something mysterious. It signifies the withdrawal of God from me. On the other hand, the homo religiosus feels also the immediate presence of God. He is endless remoteness and also the immediate presence of God. Outside and within him, God is man's haven, he feels. His fortress, his habitation, where man resides. He experiences God as his companion, father, mother, friend. But the words I'm quoting are taken from the Bible. The Bible is the book of the Judaic religious experience. Mother, friend, lover and beloved both together, who caresses his head, bent under the load of existence, and whispers words of condolence and hope to him. He is the shepherd who cares for the helpless and the weak, and carries the young in his bosom. It's a quotation from Isaiah. On the one hand, Deus absconditus, on the other hand, Deus revelatus, close to us. On the one hand, mysterium tremendum, magnum, distant, strange, and unknowable, inspiring dread and awe. On the other hand, Deus revelatus, involved in creation in every aspect of existence, addressing himself to us through every twinkle of the distant stars, through every budding tree, out of the stillness of a summer night, the cry of the infant and the innocent laughter of the child, through one's thoughts, feelings, strivings, and yearnings, and on the other hand, distant, incomprehensible, strange, far in infinity, in the recesses of infinity. He confronts us both as an adversary, as an antagonist, and as a friend, as a stranger, and as a father, as a familiar figure, if I may use this expression, and as a mysterious person. You know, Jacob, who was wrestling with the stranger, who was the stranger, if not the same God who spoke to him a night before. The experience is antithetic, it's dichotomous, it's mutually exclusive. But still, this antithesis and this dichotomy actually lends to the religious experience its uniqueness, greatness, and magnificence. But of course, we must realize, keep in mind, that while the individual homo religiosus may engage in a paradoxical experience, fraught with incommensurate aspects and incongruous themes, oscillating between complete resignation and passionate ecstatic joy, the community, the institutionalized religion, must organize its collective experience along coherent patterns and cannot afford to tolerate polarity within our religious awareness. What is good for the at an esoteric level is absolutely inoperative at a exoteric level. What is good for the few individuals, for the homines religiosi, for the great religious genius, is absolutely incomprehensible for the average person. So of course, therefore, if you will, for instance, study the history of religion, you'll find that some religions have emphasized the aspect of remoteness of God. In some in other religions, on the contrary, introduce God as a familiar figure. Although the religious experience, the private religious experience of the homo religiosus, has both motifs, the motive of remoteness and the motive of closeness as well. For instance, we'll take Christianity. Why was the concept of father-son introduced? Why is it? Why was this Trinitarian motif introduced in Christianity? Philosophically? Simply, I mean, whoever reads the literature of the fathers of the desert, reads the literature of Saint Augustine, his Confessions, his City of God, and so forth on, who will see that Christianity actually was torn by two motifs. By the motive of closeness of God and remoteness of God. By the motive of Deus absconditus, the hidden God. And by the motive of Deus revelatus, the revealed God. The God who is close to me, who within me, who has intercourse with me, who is my companion, to whom I can address myself, I can pray, I can complain, I may rebel, I may engage in a dialogue. And the final result was that Godfather is the remote one, and the Son is the one who was walking on earth, associating with people, speaking to them. That's why in Christianity, in Christian theology, you know very well, all prayers cannot be addressed to the Father unless we beseech the Son to mediate between us and the Father. Why? Because the Father is too remote for prayer. Prayer cannot reach him. There is no way for man to find access to God Father. That's why they actually simply split divinity into two entities and introduce the Son. It means the God who is close to them. Judaism, a Unitarian religion, couldn't do that. So in Judaism, it is an antithesis, a dichotomy of closeness and remoteness. Yeah. The question is, what did Judaism do with the problem of its institutionalized religion? Judaism is also, it's a private experience, it's also an institutionalized religion. Any religion must be institutionalized, because the word religion itself, indicates institutionalization. Institutionalized, conceptualized, made, so to say, available to the crowd. Because you cannot, you see, for instance, education. There were times when education was considered a privilege of the select few of the aristocratic society. In England had such a system. Actually, old Greece, actually believed in aristocracy as far as education is concerned. You can see art. Eliot says that art is only a product of the class of leisure. Okay. But no one can say that religion should be, so to say, limited to the select few for a simple reason. Because from our viewpoint, religion saves men. Gives them salvation and redemption. And we think that everybody is entitled to salvation and redemption. Not only the philosopher, but the simpleton as well. Not only the aristocrat, but the slave as well. So you cannot make turn the religious experience into an esoteric affair for the philosopher, for the inquiring mind, for the person who simply encounters God. Means and ways must be found in order to simplify the religious experience and to make it available and accessible to every person. And the dichotomous religious experience is an esoteric affair. Exoterically, the average person on the street cannot understand the dichotomy. It's either or. The principle of contradiction that Aristotle introduced into logic is simply common sense. It's either black or white. It cannot be between or gray, I mean, all right. What's either black or either it's a square or it's round. What or a circle. It cannot be both at the same time. So what did Judaism do? What motive was emphasized not in the private experience of God, the Judaic private experience? The Judaic private experience, as it was depicted and described in the Psalms, this is the greatest book on religious experience in general, I believe, and I'm never apologetic about it, but it's the greatest book of the religious experience in general. Everybody agrees to it, as far as it's concerned. The psalmist was a religious genius, I mean, the real homo religiosus. In him you find psalms, the famous psalm, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. So how is God depicted, described there? Close companion, my shepherd, I associate with him. I engage in a dialogue with him. I bend my tired head on his shoulder. And he whispers into me in words of hope to me. And the same psalmist, the next day, in the next chapter, begins to say, where can I escape from you? Where can I find you? I have searched you everywhere. I found you nowhere. I came to your sanctuary, to your temple. I thought I'll find you there, but you are not there. I searched in the woods. I didn't find your shadow. Where are you? On the one hand, he speaks of God as his companion, his shepherd. On the other hand, in the same breath, he says he can't find God. He doesn't know where he is. It's what we say, numen presence, numen absence. God is present and absent. He's right here and he's infinity. He's remote and distant. This is all right for the esoteric crowd, for the homo religiosus. But what about the community, the Jewish community? How can you, I mean, after all, we never wanted, gentlemen, the community just to live technically, religiously. I mean, this is an accusation which has been raised against us from time to time, against rabbinic legalism, against fossilization of Judaism, I mean, but against Judaism which has been converted into, I mean, turned into just dry, trite, and formal rules of conduct, technical conduct, without this great passionate experience, this paradoxical, I mean, awareness of God and man. But this is not true, gentlemen. We have both. We have a subjective experience. We also have objective correlates. But what about the subjective experience as far as the crowd is concerned? What did Judaism tell the crowd? Is God remote or not? Is he mysterium, magnum, or is he known, is he knowable? Is he my friend or is he a stranger to me? Is he familiar or alien to me? What did he say? Judaism had found actually a funny solution to it. It divided between the emotional aspects of experience and the intellectual motifs of the religious experience. Emotionally, God is close to us, intellectually, far off. Emotionally, because religious experience is a total experience. I mean, not only the intellect is involved, the intellect and the affects, the emotions and even the will is involved. It's a complex experience. Emotionally, God is close to us. Emotionally, God is the answer to all our questions. Intellectually, he's the most confusing, perplexing, and disturbing question. Emotionally, he's our friend. We know him, we feel him. We simply, what William James said, we feel the unseen reality. He is everything to us. He said, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. The intellectually, he's alien to us. He's a mystery. The most complicated mystery. the enigma which will never be unwrapped or solved or resolved. He'll remain the unknown. He's the lumen emotionally. He's the numen. Numen means the unknown. Intellectually. He's the eternal question emotionally, intellectually. He's the answer to all our questions emotionally. This is exactly. Prayer is possible. Why is prayer possible? Because prayer basically is an emotional act. Not possible, desirable. Prayer has, I mean, there is sense to prayer. Because emotionally we approach him. We come very close to him. Theology and absurdity. Why theology and absurdity? Because while prayer is a result of our emotional gesture, theology is an expression of our intellectual approach. Intellectually, we have no approach to God. He's Deus absconditus. That's why Judaism has no theology. Whoever knows a little of Maimonides, a little of Bach here, I mean, the classics, knows very well that they deny the existence and the possibility and the rationality of theology. Because theology means I approach God not only with my emotionally but intellectually. I apply categories, certain concepts, basic concepts, which I derive from finitude, from my sensuous experiences, from my here and now perceptions and sensations. These categories, these categories and concepts are not applicable to God in his transcendence and infinity. So since, ladies and gentlemen, God is intellectually an enigma, so there is why Judaism did not believe in theology. However, we can approach God emotionally. Now, even our knowledge of God is never related to his essence, but to his will, which addresses itself to man. God discloses, according to Judaism, only those verities which are practically relevant to our finite existence. And assertions about God are to be taken not in interpretive, but in a normative sense. When I say God is merciful, or God is just, so my mother says, what right do I have to say anything about him? What right do I have to attribute anything to him, or predicate anything of him? Predication is an act, I mean, when the object is close to the subject, but if there is infinity separating the object from the subject, how can I dare to predicate of God? So my mind has answered, no, you don't predicate anything of God. You predicate something about yourself, what you should do. When you say God is merciful, it doesn't mean God is merciful because you know very little about God. And the idea of mercy is an emotional reaction, I mean, to certain challenges. I mean, how can you speak about emotions of God? You only say you should be merciful. Because the principle, what is ethical to Judaism? What God does. The acts in which God engages. So we attribute certain acts to God in order we should have an opportunity to imitate him. Imitatio Dei. They predicate of God the moral activity which is meaningful to us as an ideal requiring imitation. Outside of the practical moral perspective of imitatio Dei, there isn't a single category or term of conceptual thought which is applicable to the Supreme Being. Because intellectually he is a mystery. We have therefore always considered the theological gesture a little too adventurous and futile pursuit. The first question which Judaism tries to answer pertains not to the creator, but to the creature. I say creature in the theological sense, not in the colloquial sense. Man as a creature. To man. We ask, and this is our basic inquiry, who is this unique being to whom God has addressed himself and with whom he established by covenant a community of existence? In its effort to answer this question, Judaism gradually formulated a doctrine of man. And that's exactly what we'll try to develop, this doctrine of man. What Judaism thinks of man. I'll give you an example, the problems which will have men. For instance, the problems which we'll consider. For instance, first, man in his immediacy, completely dominated by organically uniform and unbroken life processes. Man is a natural being, as a part of the organic realm. It's interesting, Judaism always believed in that, but we must know how far we may, so to say, advance this thesis. And also, you should understand, man in full exercise of his independence. In other words, Judaism deals with the old dichotomy in man, of which the psalmist and liturgist have so frequently spoken. And the preeminence of man over the beast is not for all his vanity, and yet thou hast distinguished man from the beginning, and hast recognized his privilege that he might stand before thee. It's again an antithesis. On the one hand, man is nothing new. On the other hand, man is the crown of creation. This problem we have to deal with. Second, what are the traits by which Judaism identifies the unique endowment in man in contradistinction to his universal, natural mode of existence? Why is man different, and by what he is different? Is it the intellect, as the medieval scholar thought? Is it perhaps his will, freedom of will? Does Judaism believe in freedom of will, in free action? Is it perhaps a certain mode of feeling, of his emotional experience? What is singular in man? It's a problem. In this specific, and another problem is very important, Judaism, is this specific charisma, this endowment, given to man in the form of a grant, and all man has to do is to accept it in a spirit of gratitude. You are different. God told him, you are different, you are distinct, you are unique, you are singular, take it. Or it is something for which man must reach out and struggle until the end of his sojourn on earth. Perhaps it is not a grant, it's an ideal charisma of man. And God will not realize, perhaps, the ideal, but man himself should realize. He just gave him the opportunity, but didn't give him any grant. It's also a problem. Christianity basically believes that it's a grant. Of course, man can distort the grant. Man can corrupt this charisma, this specific endowment. He can also, so to say, prove himself grateful and watch over it. But basically, it is given by God. This is the concept of grace. The question is whether we know of the concept of grace. Is there grace in Judaism? Or perhaps man is free either to rise to the heights of angels or to descend to the low depths of a devil. He has the opportunity, but no grant. This should be discussed. Third, if the latter alternative be true, that charisma, the unique charisma of man, is not a grant, a ready-made grant, that all man has to do is to, all man has to do is to accept it, but it's more an ideal, it's a challenge to man. So, how can man realize his endowment and actualize his capacity for a meaningful life? How is it possible? Simply a question of techne, a technical problem. What are the phases of man's ascent from an insensate state of affairs to a redeemed existence? There is an ascent. Man climbs up the mount of the law. If we may use a phrase by the psalmist, what are the phases of this ascent? At the bottom, man is an insensate being, like the animal. On the top, he leads a meaningful life. What are the phases of his great ascent from meaninglessness to meaningfulness? Indeed, these are problems also psychology can deal with, and secular ethics can deal with. But there are problems, nevertheless, very important as far as religion is concerned. Fourth, what is the relationship of Judaism to man's impulses and to his craving for hedonism, for carnal pleasure? Has Judaism acted realistically and recommended unqualified approval of such physiological drives, manifesting man's naturalness, or has it condemned them and accepted a monastic morality? There are certain, you know, of course, if you'll ask, I mean, on the street, any rabbi, he'll tell you, of course, Judaism rejected monastic philosophy. It's easy to say, but it's hard to prove. I mean, because monastic philosophy should not, that Christianity, I mean, medieval Christianity has accepted, should not be just rejected with contempt. We should understand the reasons why. The reasons, what prompted them, the metaphysical and philosophical reasons. What prompted a man like Bernard von Clairvaux, or St. Augustine, a deep, great mind, one of the greatest religious minds that ever lived on this earth, St. Augustine. Why was he inclined toward monasticism? There is a reason for it. And you should understand why Judaism, if Judaism has rejected, or perhaps limited the theory of monasticism, why and what manner? Is there perhaps another solution to this problem, besides these two extremes? On the one hand, the hedonism, on the other hand, monasticism. Perhaps there's a middle solution, a golden mean. I don't know. Fifth, we have to consider, is the existential experience of man mainly an awareness of his individuality and uniqueness, and hence an experience of retreat from others? It means the basic existential experience is a secluded one. Man for himself, man in seclusion. Solitary man experiences existence as for himself. Basically, in his existential experience, I mean, he sees only himself. The other self does not enter into his existential experience. Call it solitariness, call it egocentrism. The terms are simply irrelevant. Is it just an experience of man in seclusion? Or does it express itself in an indomitable yearning for communal existence, related and committed to others? In other words, has Judaism dealt with man for himself as a secluded existence, or with man in communion with the other self? This is the problem, the passage from secluded existence to existence in communion. It's a problem which we investigated properly. Sixth, for instance, Platonic or Aristotelian personalism, question mind and soul. You know, Christians distinguish very strictly, very carefully between mind and soul. Mind is a part of natural man, soul is the transcendental endowment. Does Judaism know of that? Is the Judaic doctrine of man voluntaristic or intellectualistic? What did Judaism give the primacy? To the voluntas or to the intellect? Is man a rational being? Whatever he does is examined, tested, by the ratio, by the intellect. He never does anything which is foolish. I mean, it's very, very hard to say nowadays, but let's abstract from this world, from the politics and all follies of man. But basically, is a rational being, or on the contrary, man is not a rational being. Man is driven by some will, as Schopenhauer said, will is a blind will, basically non-rational will. But the attitude of Judaism is important, as even with regard to practical problems. And also, of course, the question of freedom and determinism. But is man a free being or a determined being? Is the law of causality operative in man's life, in his spiritual life? I mean, I don't mean his physiological life. Or there is full freedom. And ninth, and eighth, the problem of theodicy, the problem of evil. It's a very important problem. Man's response to suffering. The question is, what is suffering? The second question, why suffering? The third question, how should man respond to suffering? This is a very important problem. And for modern man, perhaps, it is the most exquisite and the most outstanding. So you want to ask me some questions, or shall I go on?
Rabbi, I'd like to ask you a question. In the way, in the early part of your talk, you have been developing a number of paradoxes, and it seems to me there was a paradox implicit in what you were developing.
Yes.
In the distinction between the man of religion and the man of science, that
yes.
is, the paradox being that as you developed the distinction between them, you also developed how what they have in common, that they are almost indistinguishable.
They have in common? Of course, I mean...
That they are not, in other words, that they are almost indistinguishable.
Yes, I'll tell you. For instance, there is no... You see, if people belong... I mean, if two beings should belong to two kinds, generically different... So you cannot speak, you cannot differentiate between them, because actually you can't compare it. Differentiation is always possible when comparison is in place. And because, I mean, if the homo religiosus would have no, so to say, no concern for knowledge, then I wouldn't distinguish between him and the man of science. Because what is the, I mean, we cannot distinguish between a two-dimensional magnitude and a three-dimensional magnitude. The fact that this is two-dimensional, this is three-dimensional, or the other one, the third one is one-dimensional, this itself, I mean, settles all comparisons. But since the homo religiosus is an intellectual type, craving for knowledge, then I try to find the distinctions. But there is a common denominator on that, certainly, of course.
Even to the act of resignation, there's a common denominator.
You mean for the scientist?
Scientist has it implicit.
You mean the scientist also performs the movement of resignation?
Yes.
If I may employ Kierkegaardian language, yes. We'll come to it later. We'll see. We'll analyze modern science and... It's a philosophical approach. I mean, I'll tell you, when I read the press in America, when they speak about controlling the universe and about exploring all mysteries of being, I don't believe they are so humble in performing the movement of resignation. Sometimes when I read statements, mostly written not by scientists, but by journalists or by people who write about science, who are not creative scientists, I simply, if I may use a Sartre's expression, I feel a nauseating nausea about existence in general, because there is arrogance of man. And if there is something wrong and simply undignified in man, is arrogance. I don't believe they perform the so to say, the movement of resignation, but we'll discuss it later. It's very important for the scientists. If they would perform, there would be a different world. Yes, sir.
In the early theory of positivism.
Yes.
Would you classify them as homo religiosus?
Certainly.
You would?
Certainly. And not all Hasidic rabbis.
No.
I mean, the fathers of Hasidism.
Yeah,
take for instance the Baal Shem Tov.
Baal Shem Tov, you would?
Certainly. Yes. As a genius. As a homo religiosus, a genius.
That's an extraordinary
example. Yeah, yes, it's an extraordinary. You laughed me. I expected a second part of your question. But intellectually, they were not at a high level.
But would you say there was any homo theoreticus in
Baal Shem Tov? Yes, implicitly.
Yes.
He didn't develop it. Homo theoreticus in a homo religiosus depends simply upon circumstance, upon the environment. Certainly the homo religiosus of today has a better opportunity to develop his knowledge and to realize his intellectual ambitions than the Baal Shem Tov who lived in some village, I mean, in the 18th century, I mean, in a world full of ignorance and absolutely no concept of nature and environment. But there was a homo theoreticus, that his interpretation of nature was wrong. It's not his fault. It's the fault of society and the fault of age. Even Aristotle made mistakes about interpreting nature.
Do you have documentary evidence of that, or is that any kind of a...
You mean,
Jewish
first of all, I told you at the outset that whatever I say is subjective.
I don't...
But however, as far as this is concerned, I could prove it to you. Yeah, I could prove it to you by his writing.
Isn't there implying the survival of Hasidism, the concept that it was not necessary to accompany that with an intellectual appreciation?
Oh, you are right, as far as this is concerned. But about what revival are you speaking? I would like to know. The modern revival of Hasidism. To me, it means escapism. You know, escape where from? From life on the one hand, and from religion on the other.
You're implying a marked deviation from the original.
Yeah, absolutely. You mean the Buberian revivalism. By Buber, let's take. Yeah, by Buber, yeah. This is the finest one. Of course, Buber is exactly wrong in that. that he sees, because Buber is a German Jew. Germany was simply under the influence of Schleiermacher and the so-called religious pietism. Religion was reduced to pietism. It means it's a subjective experience, basically an emotional experience. So in order to present Judaism, I mean, to the German philosophers or to the German religious person, so actually he described an emotional experience. You are right that Buber's Hasidism, neo-Hasidism, has absolutely no intellectual motives. Correct? It's an ecstatic experience. When experience becomes ecstatic, it cannot be it cannot, so to say, engage in any intellectual gesture. Because if one gets out of mind what ecstasy means, he cannot think. I mean, very simply. But this is not genuine Hasidism.
But I would infer from that that even the Buber concept is on a somewhat lower level.
I don't understand what you mean.
Because it is purely emotional.
It's emotional,
yes.
It
doesn't have an intellectual...
No intellectual basis, the way he described the Baal Shem Tov.
Therefore, two things may happen. Either the emotion may run dry, and there is very little left to sustain it.
Yes, correct.
Or that it actually is not the... true manifestation of what we think.
You are right. First of all, the emotion may run dry, or it may become mysticism. You see, the road from emotionalism to mysticism is not a too long one, and you can land in the realm of mysticism very easily, I mean, before you know. You see, and Buber basically has performed this. He's almost a mystic. What I must say about Buber himself, he himself is also, in a certain respect, a homo religiosus, no doubt about it. I may criticize certain aspects of his philosophy. As Buber is a homo religiosus, Buber's homo religiosus is not only an emotional type, but is also an intellectual one, no doubt about it. After all, he developed a philosophy, the Aitao philosophy, whatever you call it. But the way he describes the Baal Shem Tov and the other fathers of Hasidism, of course, he reduces the Hasidic movement to an affective experience. Not intellectual, cognitive experience. Yes?
No, I was merely going to make the observation that Buber is also associated with a modern revival of existentialism, too.
Yeah, existentialism, basically, there are so many trends, so many aspects to existentialism, but existentialism basically is a... now, for instance, take Sartre. Sartre is atheistic, agnostic. But take Jasper, or take the father of existentialism, Kierkegaard, he's the father, actually. He was intellectual type, no doubt about that. You cannot really say Kierkegaard was just... I mean, the greatness of Kierkegaard expressed itself in his emotional experience. Because emotionally, he was a psychopath, I would say. He was mad, if I may use this expression. The man was not normal, but intellectually, he was a genius. Great. Great. One of the greatest thinkers, in my opinion, who ever lived. But he was intellectual type too, yes?
In the Judaic experience, in the dichotomy that exists, it's interesting that the Ten Commandments were given to Moses, who in turn gave it to the people.
Correct.
And when you talk about bringing this to the crowd, to the people, as an emotional experience, it had to go through Moshe Rabbeinu, who went to God.
I could add to your remark that the Bible says that the people said to Moses, speak with God, because we are afraid, because we speak with God, we should die. What does it mean? This is mysterium magnum, mysterium tremendum. Man is filled not with love, but is filled with awe, tremor, fear. Vayonu vayan orek, they have retreated from the Mount Sinai. This exactly, I mean, this is not the familiar, the aspect of familiarity with God, but the aspect of dread, the dreadfulness of God. What in Hebrew you call Nora, means dreadful, awesome, far away. You see it, of course. But basically, emotionally, the Jewish people were trained to consider God as a companion, as a friend, intellectually as a stranger.
Rabbi, how does that differ from the Son of God?
It's the same God.
I know, but when you say that the difference between Jesus as the Son of God, as the representative of the people in dealing with God, isn't that comparable to the same?
This is only subjective. It's only a subjective dichotomy on our part that emotionally we approach God in a different manner than intellectually, but God is one.
But doesn't the Christian do that the same as the Jew?
No, he has two entities. I mean, three entities. Yeah, I mean, I'm not speaking about the ghost. The ghost I never understood. Why there was need for the third entity, I could never understand. I mean, I'm not joking. I could never understand. This is due to some expressions in the Bible, Ruach Elokim, the Spirit of God. But there was no need for it at all. There was no need for it at all. It's only, you see, the need was between the birth of Christ, you see, and the Annunciation, so to say, what they call it. When Mary, I mean, was informed, advised, that she's going to give birth to a son. So who advised Mary about it? This was the necessity. Who advised Mary about it? The father? Father doesn't address himself to anybody. He's silent. So the son hasn't been born yet. So this is why this third agent was introduced. What's his name? The ghost, the Holy Ghost. But theologically, he gives a lot of headaches, I mean, to Christians. I mean, they could never digest this ghost. They try to find a place for him, but it's very dark, twisting around theological thoughts and ideas. But his son and father, this is simply remoteness and closeness of God. But to us, it's only a psychological approach, a metaphysical approach. To them, it was apostatized, absolutized, and turned into two entities. One entity, an entity that is removed from us, the other entity that is close to us.
But they've reduced it, you say, to two entities. We haven't reduced it to two entities, yet you say there's an antithesis between the remoteness and the closeness of God, on our part. Yet don't they, even with their two entities, have that same closeness and remoteness as you've expressed it?
Yes, they have it too. But their closeness is to the Son, their remoteness is far as the Father is concerned.
But the Son is a separate entity, as not part of God.
He's separate in one, I mean. He's separate in one, you know that, I mean. There are three entities in one.
You see, we separate.
There is unity, I mean. When you tell a Christian that he doesn't believe in the unity of God, he'll deny it, you see.
Yeah.
But it's unity and Trinity. I mean, I don't understand it. I don't believe they understand it too well. So it's no use, I mean, discussing it. But to them, our subjective dichotomy was apostatized and actually turned into two divinities, so to say. All right, then the united divinities. Yes?
You say that an incisive criticism of reconstructionism would be that it's near homo theoreticus and removing itself.
Which reconstructionism you mean? The American reconstructionism of Dr. Kaplan? The main criticism, I'll tell you what the main criticism is. It's too logical and too business-like. I understand it too well. This is a trouble.
That's what I meant.
It's arranged too neatly arranged. It's too commercially, I mean, advertised. And it's too logical. The paradox, there is no paradox in the reconstruction. There's no absurdity in reconstructionism. And I don't believe that a religious experience can be performed if there is no aspect of absurdity in it. If there is no absurdity, there's no religious experience. Then it's business. Then it is pragmos. If it's pragmos, it's very neatly arranged. It's this, I mean, we'll come to it, and I'll develop this idea.
Follow that up sometime.
Sure, I'll come to it. I mean, this is known since Kierkegaard, and Judaism has known it since antiquity. The religious experience deals with certain aspects of absurdity. If the element of absurdity is lacking, there is no religious experience.
Are you trying to equate absurdity?
No,
with
I'm not saying that rational, I'm saying absurd. I cannot develop this idea, I'll come later.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound a bit to sound absurd. Yeah?
You attribute to man a humbleness because you attribute to man a
mishigas,
absurdity.
Yes, you go, yes. You know what my mind said? You use the expression mishigas. My mind says there is an expression in the psalm, shigayon le David. Shigayon le David means basically David mistakes. But my mind has replaced the yud with an iron, and it's called shigayon le David, David's madness. The love for God is madness on the part.
Yes, correct. In modern psychology, trying to see primary thoughts and secondary thoughts. Primary thoughts in terms of the unconscious,
yes.
And secondary thoughts in terms of the irrational, the
yes.
Developmental.
You're conceptualized, I mean, irrationalized, yes?
Well, I'm just wondering if the treatment of psychology, the furtherance of psychology, will strengthen your own position in relation to the concept of God being both one close. Being one, a theoretical experience as well as being an emotional
I'll
experience.
Tell you, if you'll take any book on psychology of religion, you'll find it. You'll find this antithesis. There's nothing new in it. You'll find it. And I can say it from my own experience. And studying the text, the classical texts of, the religious classical texts, And it is. You may say that this applies even to persons as well sometimes. And yes, will come to it, perhaps. This dichotomy is not confined to God, but extends, in our relationships with other persons. We are close to them and far from them. Perhaps the same applies to husband and wife as well. Quite possible. After all, man is imitatio Dei, the image of God. What is true of God is true also in miniature of man. Yes.
How do you define absurdity and how do you distinguish it from mysticism, or is it synonymous?
No, mysticism has no absurdities because mysticism has no criterion of rationality. So you couldn't speak of absurdity. In order to be absurd, one must be rational. Because otherwise, if he's not rational, his absurdity doesn't say anything to him. The mystic is not rational. The mystic is an ecstatic experience. Ecstasy in Greek means out of mind. It's simply man has abandoned his intellectual position in the world and gave himself to something other. You see. But as far as absurdity is concerned, please don't take it at its face value. We'll come to it. We'll have to deal with this problem. Otherwise, religion has nothing to say.
I was just wondering one other thing. This whole area of man in relation to God, this whole area of concept of man, God being close and getting close.
Yes.
And I think it's not in terms of possible or anything, but present day man's relationship to analyst, a therapist, this whole area of man's closeness, the attempt to get closeness to himself, as well as man's recognition of the of remoteness.
No, thank you. That's just in what has nothing to do with it. But, yes, in terms of how, yes?
I was just trying to...
Mean to himself, you mean?
Well, I'm just trying to see in some sort
of... Of course, you'll find parallels also in our, so to say, communal relations, or so to say, in the relationship of the self to the non-self. Of course, this antithesis of closeness and remoteness. I started with this dichotomy with regard to God, but it'll have to descend to the level of man. Otherwise, it's not the psychology of religion we are interested in, we are interested in man.
So next time we hope to be here on time, and we will have then a longer period and a break in the middle so that we can ask questions and so on.
I haven't finished the introduction. I haven't developed yet the question how to approach, how you can approach this. It's a question of introduction, of method. It's not all.
My rabbi, next time you get your own thoughts.
I beg your pardon?
I thank the rabbi Belkin. The next time you won't be caught in traffic and you want me to be served.
Rabbi, we'll be talking more about this.
Yes, sir.
How the community and institutionalized religion meets this dichotomous situation.
Yes, right.
We'll be talking more about that.
Yes,
because I'm very much interested in what
is
very important for us.
Early, because that has very direct application.
That's right.
To a great many things that we do. What is our obligation as Jewish agencies?
I understand. I'll come to it.
Yes,
but first we have to develop a philosophy of mind.
Yeah.
But we won't.
You see, it's no use of taking this. Of employing this Greek method, pragmatic method, pragmas, see how should we act? First, you should know who this subject of action is. We'll come to it, the text, let's say, to the pragmatic aspect, but you'll have to suffer a bit of metaphysics of man before you come to technical problems. Well, you can't help it. What can I do? I can't help it.
Very good.
It's not a matter of pragmatic.
We want to be sure that
it's a clear understanding of what is this institution. How it
evolved. Of religion means, yes.
How that evolved, not so much what
I'll also about. Speak about the question of happiness of man, problem of peace of mind in religion, whether it is a goal or it isn't the ultimate end of religion. I'll take up all these problems. Because there are many problems, yes, the problems are complex, yes? So.
What is the bibliography that you want us to pursue? So
bibliography? Jewish, I have none.
Not even the Guide to the Perplexed.
The Guide to the Perplexed is very good, very good. From time to time, I'll assign you chapters. But I wouldn't recommend to you to engage in the study of the Guide to the Perplexed. It'll take too much time. You are too busy people. It's a job for me, it's all right. I have a lot of class time. And I get, and they pay me for that. But no, Jewish, I have the guide of perplexed, of course. I mean, I'll give a list to Rabbi Feldman. Yes, certain selected chapters, and also from medieval literature, which is available in English. But of course, there's a general literature in a theological literature, I would recommend to you. I'll bring you the list. I mean, general theological literature, which would, of course, I mean, analyze these problems from the Christian viewpoint. But in many respects, we'll meet. I mean, there are distinctions, but there are also similarities as well. I'll give you a list of if you would like to follow up.